Since I started this podcast, I've gotten guests from a few different sources. Sometimes there are beloved friends and family that have agreed to throw me a bone now and then. Sometimes there are new friends I've made from different corners of the internet. And sometimes guests just happen upon you. All I can tell you is, guys, don't be afraid to shoot your shot. Welcome to your favorite book. I am excited to tell you that our guest today is the host and creator of the Fuckboys of Literature podcast, Emily Edwards. How the hell are you?
I'm doing so well. I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
I am so happy to have you here. I had to use your intro. Apologies.
Since we've been recording in quarantine, I've been saying, like, that is the hardest, most loaded question you're going to get. How are you doing? Like, feel free to vent if you want, but I try to keep it a little bit upbeat and happy.
Absolutely. And we all need that. I think podcasts have just become so important these last several months because they keep things light and we forget about the void that is 2020.
Exactly.
Right. So for everybody listening today, like I said, Emily Edwards is the host of Fuckboys of Literature. Emily, can you tell us a bit about your show and a bit about yourself?
You bet. Fuckboys of Literature is a comedy podcast about the toxic people of literature. So fuckboy being a gender neutral term, we discuss all sorts of mad, bad, and dangerous to know folk in the literary world, including anything from characters to writers themselves. So it started as a joke and it's turned into an absolutely fun passion project of mine. And I get to read all sorts of really fantastic books that I never read when I was a literature major in college because I was a very bad student. And now I get to make fun of it in the way that I probably would have in class and gotten all the disdain of my professors.
I love that. I also love that you called yourself a bad student because I too was an English major in college. And that's probably when I did my least reading was as a student. Yes. Just because I didn't want to read any of it. And I was distracted by college just as an entity. And I only really discovered reading back when it, like, later on when it became something I had to, like, find time to do, like in the middle of my work day or something like that.
Yeah. I fully believe that being an English or literature major is learning how to not read books, but convince people you read the books. And you know what? That is a very valuable skill.
Absolutely. I can't tell you the number of books, like I don't think any of my professors listen to this, but I can't tell you the number of books that I've, like, read the back of, skimmed a few chapters, looked up the Wikipedia page, and I'm like, I'm ready for discussion. And I'll say my points and peace out. And I sound great.
Exactly. I'm glad you get it. I'm glad we're on the same page.
I get it. But I also have really enjoyed, you know, running a book podcast for exactly this reason. You read all sorts of stuff you never would have read before. And I have a lot to thank your podcast for. It kind of showed me that running a book podcast was indeed possible, that there was sort of room to have a funny discussion-based literary podcast and that there were fans potentially for people like that. And so I have to thank you for running your show. If anyone is not a listener of Emily's podcast, do check it out. I'll have links in the description and everything like that, but definitely check her show out.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, like, I don't take anything really seriously. It's kind of a coping mechanism, but, like, there's no reason to take literature as seriously as people do. Like, it's for fun. Almost all of the famous literature that you've ever been assigned or ever read was popular culture at some point. Just enjoy it. And I mean, you can dissect it all you want, which we do on your show and mine, but, like, take it with a pinch of salt and have some fun with it. Honestly, it's the only way you're getting through Middlemarch.
I hope my mom's listening because my mom did her senior thesis on Middlemarch. So and she almost suggested it for her episode of the show. And I'm like, Mom, no. She suggested Middlemarch. She suggested Ulysses. And I was like, Mom, no.
No, something under 600 pages. That's
I got her to compromise, but it was a bit of a struggle. But anyway, Emily, I am so happy that the book you chose today was under 600 pages and actually really interesting and something that I had never had on my radar before. And so for everyone listening today, our episode is on Mother Night by Kurt Vonnegut, one of his early novels, a novel I had never heard of before you had mentioned it. And so we're going to delve into everything about this book today. And so to provide everyone listening a brief summary, so this episode, we're going to attempt to be as spoiler-free as possible. Obviously, this book is over 50 years old, but it's still, you know, really interesting. There's definitely twists and turns, which I don't want to spoil. But the summary of this book overall, a couple sentences. In this black comedy novel, we are thrown into the story of Howard J. Campbell, a Nazi propagandist and claimed American spy, as well as his oncoming trial for war crimes. Who is this man? Is he guilty? And what does it all matter in the end? Maybe only time will tell. So that was my hastily written summary at 6 this morning. So...
I love it. It was perfect. It's a really good log line.
Thank you. I'm working on it. And then so like a lot of the other books I've talked about on the show, this is a hard book to capture in a couple of sentences. So we're going to try to do it justice in a 45-minute podcast. But before we jump into the book proper, Emily, can you tell me a little bit about when you found this book?
Sure. Believe it or not, I took a very weird English class my senior year of high school. And I was a big old book nerd and I had two choices. And it was, you know, for like a weighted sort of advanced or honors English class. And there was either AP English or a class called UConn English, because I'm from Connecticut. Mm-hmm. It was essentially the freshman year reading list and course for UConn. I didn't end up going there, but I ended up taking UConn English. And the book list for that was, I want to say, about half a dozen Kurt Vonnegut novels. Mm-hmm. And we started with Slaughterhouse-Five. We did Cat's Cradle. And then we read Mother Night. And I was just blown out of the water by this book. I just thought it was the most brilliant, satirical, and incredibly dark, like just grappling with like human emotion in a way that I had not ever seen in a book. And in order to, and I was so impressed that I was taught to read something that is essentially pop culture as though it was high literature. Mm-hmm. And so after, while I was studying this book, like, and going through it and also learning a lot more about the Holocaust and World War II, I just was really like knocked on my butt and I just fell in love with this book.
Yeah, I can definitely see a lot of what you're saying here. And I really like that you mentioned that this is essentially pop culture that was sort of transported as high literature, because you read this book and it reads like incredibly smoothly. You can imagine just about anybody picking this book up, especially in Kurt Vonnegut's time, just finding this on a shelf somewhere. It doesn't necessarily read like high literature, even of his time. It reads really accessibly.
Yeah, like it's a pretty early book, as you mentioned. You know, he wrote an awful lot for the majority of his life. And I think it was first published in the early 60s. So 1961 was when it was first published. And, you know, so it's obviously not long after the end of World War II. You have a bunch of veterans and people who are really probably dealing with PTSD and other mental illnesses after serving in the war. Kurt Vonnegut himself had a really bad war. And, you know, I think that this book gave people, or I assume that this book kind of gave people a means to deal with incredibly dark feelings and incredibly dark memories in a way that's so farcical and funny, even though it's an incredibly emotional book.
Right. Yeah. This book sort of takes on the feelings associated with the post-war in sort of this numb, bleak tone, which I'm definitely going to talk about later. And if you think about a lot of other post-war literature, I can't really think of too many other writers that have this level of almost satire to it. I mean, the person that really comes to mind for me when I think about post-war literature or writing in the aftermath of war is Ernest Hemingway for World War I. Mm-hmm. And he also has this sort of numb tone in a lot of his books, but that's just kind of how he writes everything. But it's not, there's not that humor to it. There's a humor here.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of other mid-century writers that have sort of been suggested to me for me to do on my show that I am avoiding like the absolute plague because like I don't want to read Norman Mailer. I don't want to read John Updike because they don't have the same sort of they're so obsessed with their own feelings and emotions, but not in a way of wanting to get through them. To me, those writers and a lot of mid-century male writers feel like they just want to sit in their sadness and their negative emotions about what happened to them and what they were put through. Whereas I feel like Kurt Vonnegut, like he survived the bombing of Dresden, which is part of his book of Slaughterhouse-Five. And so like he had a really bad go of it. And I feel like he's one of the only mid-century writers that I can think of that wanted to feel joy again. And whether or not he did it through black humor or like other like really satirical writing, he did eventually find hope again. He did eventually want better for society and people at large. And that's something that I connect with really, really well in his writing.
I definitely agree with that. There's also a certain level of self-awareness that you can pick up here, like in terms of his characters, in terms of whatever of himself he's putting in. You get the essence that this is a man that's aware of his own flaws, which you sometimes don't get with some of those other mid-century male writers. They're not quite as self-aware.
No, not at all.
But it's so interesting that you mentioned some of those other writers because unlike you, you came to this reading other Vonnegut novels. Mm-hmm. I have a very different experience with Kurt Vonnegut. And by that, I mean almost no experience at all. So my experience with Kurt Vonnegut is when I was 12 years old, I read Harrison Bergeron and I thought it was the coolest story ever when I was 12.
It is really cool though.
I think it's cool. I read it in like a textbook somewhere. And then later in like 10 years ago, I think I read Slaughterhouse-Five and I have absolutely no memory of the book. Like it was 10 years ago. I remember books from 10 years ago, but I have no memory of Slaughterhouse-Five. It somehow just did not make an impact on me. And I don't know why that was. And then over the years, I've always thought, you know, maybe I should read that book again. Maybe I should come back to Kurt Vonnegut, but I never have. And in sort of unpacking that, I realized I have sort of lumped Vonnegut in with certain other writers over the years. Mm-hmm. And as you often take on, you know, gendered literature a lot in your podcast, I'm wondering if you can probably identify with this, but I kind of sort of lumped him in as one of the three writers that straight males tend to read.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He is definitely one of those writers where, you know, I had a conversation with Dana Schwartz, who wrote, like the male writers of the Western canon, you know, that satirical book that she had written. And Kurt Vonnegut is in there and he is definitely a dude writer. Like he talks about sex, he talks about violence, everything is very cavalier and it's written in a tone that everything he writes is written in a tone of just like sarcastic detachment. And I think that a lot of readers don't usually get past that sort of like emotional detachment. Like they feel like they're not supposed to feel feelings. But I think that if you allow yourself to understand, at least this is how I read Kurt Vonnegut. Other people may feel very differently. I think if you allow yourself to understand that this is coming from a place of hurt and almost everything he does write comes from a place of hurt, it takes on a slightly different meaning. But I will say his writing is very mid-century sexist and it is still very mid-century and modern day racist. Like there are words I do not like that I would never use now. Like it is very of his time and of his place. And I don't think he ever learned any better. So I will say that.
Yep. I definitely feel you there. I had him lumped in with like writers that thematically he doesn't really go with. I have him lumped in my head with David Foster Wallace and like Cormac McCarthy, basically like the writers that dudes read. And that's in of itself not a bad thing. I think I'm just coming at it with my English major background where I always had a mistrust of straight male English majors.
Oh, totally.
And whenever they were there, I just didn't trust them. I'm like, why are you here? Like, you just want us all to read Infinite Jest, don't you? Like,
yeah. No, there's definitely that. Like, I don't think I've ever been friends with a straight guy who also really liked Kurt Vonnegut. I'm like, you and I are not taking the same thing out of this. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of have like I honestly do have a very like hesitant approach to straight dudes, and especially straight white dudes who love Kurt Vonnegut, because I'm like, you're probably not seeing the social commentary, or at least you're not, it doesn't hit you the same way that it hits me.
Right. Yeah, completely. And so this whole podcast has been sort of an exercise in overcoming my own literary biases. So I will say that if you had been a man who recommended this book to me, I would have come into this a lot more skeptical.
Okay. No, I don't blame you. I don't blame you at all. And, you know, the first time that I had really gone through a lot of Kurt Vonnegut's books, mm-hmm. I know I didn't see all the racism and the sexism there. Mm-hmm. And of course, now as I read it, I read this book probably once a year. And I've reread a bunch of his other books as well. Like, I have, my emotions towards the text have changed, but mm-hmm. I still will say this is probably my favorite book of all time.
I really like that. And you segued quite nicely into my next question. And that is, so you reread this book every year, and a lot of mm-hmm. my guests have different perspectives on rereading, especially with a favorite. How would you describe your opinion of this book, or your attitude towards this book, changing with time?
It's difficult because, especially in 2020, my perspective on can I mention that essentially he's in jail for being a Nazi?
Yep.
Okay, cool. So that's just the essential premise of the book, is that Howard Campbell is in jail for being an American Nazi. Obviously, that hits different and has hit very different since 2016. Mm-hmm. So, you know, being an adult and watching all of this happen in the last 5 or 10 years, or rather not happen, but be more prominent and reported on in the news and acknowledged by society in the last 5 or 10 years, my understanding of the motives behind Campbell have changed significantly. I used to, when I first read it, I thought it was like, well, isn't that a funny idea? You know, like an American Nazi. Those never existed. And, you know, because I was an idiot 16-year-old. But, you know, now obviously as I've grown up and I've seen just the prevalence of all of this, it's just gotten more deep. It's more deep and more in tune with actual society than I ever thought it was going to be.
And there is this impression that characters like Campbell, or people like Campbell, just don't exist in the world. But I find him a really interesting character just because he is so run of the mill. Mm-hmm. There are other pieces of literature that I think of that really take on this idea of the radicalization or the conversion of just the average person. I think the most obvious book is The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which came out a few years ago. Obviously, completely different faith, completely different context, but the idea mm-hmm. of that is just an ordinary person becoming radicalized. And for whatever reason, sometimes those reasons are fascinating, and sometimes it's left ambiguous in a lot of ways as to what their motives are. And you realize maybe sometimes that's not the most relevant thing.
Yeah, you know, and I think for me, the most glaring and uncomfortable aspect of this is just how Howard relates to his past and how often he doesn't want to see consequences for the choices that he made. And to me, that is the most human aspect of this book mm-hmm. in a way that, you know, his grappling with the consequences and of conscious decisions he made where he could have stopped at any time is just the most prescient and interesting aspect of this book. Whereas, like, especially in the last year, I've suggested people read this many times mm-hmm. because I just, you know, I don't think that there's a way. For me, it fully explains how people are behaving in the year 2020 and like why they feel like they can get away with political decisions and political opinions that they've had and feel like nothing bad should happen to them. Like, it's a brilliant character study in those kinds of people.
I agree. And you are so good at segueing to my next question every single time. But the next thing is, I often ask my patients, I'm sorry, I'm a genetic counselor.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny.
I often ask my guests, how is this book recommending to other people? Do people read it when you recommend it? Have you ever gotten feedback about it? How do other people take this book in your life?
You know, I do recommend it a lot. And I would say like 30% of the time, someone will go, oh, I've already read that. And I can say like, fine, like once is probably enough for most normal human beings. And then I'll recommend it to other people and they'll often have the same sort of response that you might have had where it was just kind of like, no, Kurt Vonnegut is not an author for me, which again, like I don't like to push books on people like because I know how annoying it is. Like sometimes you just have a visceral response where you're just like, I don't want to read that. And that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. Like I will never read Ayn Rand. It's never going to happen. I'm sorry. Like it's just never going to happen. But I will say that earlier on in quarantine, like my mom lives with me. So she lives with me and she was like, I need something to read because I'm bored out of my mind. And so I was like, how about you read my favorite book and handed it to her. And I want to say like 3 days later, she came up to me and she was just like, what the hell is wrong with you? And I was just kind of like, oh, I forgot that this book is bleak. It is dark and it is bleak and it is kind of monstrous. And if you're really not prepared for that, it's gonna whack you in the face in a way that you're probably not prepared for. So I would say like a good chunk of the time I have suggested for people to read it and then they like kind of don't really talk to me anymore.
That is so cool. I'm so glad you shared that with your mother. That what a joy that must have been.
And I was just kind of like, I'm sorry. Like, I really didn't think you weren't going to be prepared for this, but I totally understand why this was not what you were expecting.
Right. And there's this certain vulnerability that I found with recommending your favorite book. I'm sometimes judicious with recommending a favorite. I'm just like, hey, you may not like this, but I do. I'm always like protective of it in a way. And so The example I give is ever since I started this podcast, I've mentioned my personal favorite book a number of times, which is East of Eden by John Steinbeck. And my mother-in-law picked it up recently. And my mother-in-law was also an English major. She listens to this. Hi, Susan. she picked it up recently. And she said, I liked it, but it's kind of misogynist. And I was like, you're right, but aw.
Yeah. Exactly. My mother was just staring at me like, what she was, I could see in her brain going like, maybe I should have put you in therapy. Like, cause this is a very bleak book. And I, when you said East of Eden, I was like, wow, that is a choice.
And it's a story. I'll talk about it at length another time, but basically, I admire that you recommend this freely, and I am glad that you chose this to read because it sort of broke down my misgivings about Vonnegut, and I looked into him a little bit. I was surprised to learn he was from Indiana, but apparently this is like a big thing in Indiana, and the reason I'm surprised about that is because I went to college in Indiana. I work in Indiana. Like, I am no stranger to Indiana. Like, I go there like every other day, and so I'm like, how did I not know this?
Oh, weird. Yeah, no, he's Indianapolis born and bred, basically. And then his other main sort of setting for a lot of his stories is upstate New York, which is where a lot of my family lives. And that's really about it. It's just like he just bings back and forth between those two locations.
Yeah, he's got the New York. He's got that heartland thing. So that was a fun little discovery. And anyway, going into the book itself, because I'm going to come back to Vonnegut's other work in a little bit.
Okay, because I was going to say, like, some of them are clunkers. I will totally give you that. Some of them are really not very good.
I'm definitely going to ask you about that because I want to sort of, since you've read some of this catalog, I want to sort of put this in with the rest of his catalog, but we'll table that for now. But talk about this particular book. I usually set up these episodes into like what I liked and what I don't like, but this book, it's really weird to make that distinction because I classify this book personally is one of those books I respect more than I like.
I think that's fair.
I think it's probably the subject matter, the tone. I think plot-wise, I think this is beautifully constructed. Just as a piece of literature, I think this is beautifully constructed. There's all the lovely twists and turns. I feel invested in Campbell's story. And one of the interesting things this book does is the individual chapters themselves are all quite short, but they're also beautifully crafted as like small little entities. And it was almost a thing of just really great construction. It made me think back to Harrison Bergeron, which is such a cool short story. And he brings that same sort of short energy to this book. And so one of those chapters I'll give as an example, he is sitting at a barber shop. He is reading about the hanging of his father-in-law. And then he's reading about this. And then the chapter ends with the barber saying, "Next." And it's just such a beautiful framing. Like you immediately know what Vonnegut is doing there with that juxtaposition. And he does it over and over with, you know, the prison guards that Campbell has, like the way they're framed and described.
Yeah.
I think beautifully done, like really admired that.
I agree. You know, I think one of my favorite things about this book is that it uses one of my favorite literary devices in that it's not quite a found manuscript, but it is like the concept of like a manuscript that Kurt Vonnegut writes he's come across, you know what I mean? And he's just like, oh, this was written by someone else. It's their story. So all of these things must be true, or at least like it's how Howard Campbell wants us to know his story. And so he sets it up actually, like even in the very beginning, with like an editor's note of like, this is how I feel about the story. And I'm going to let you have your own feelings once you read the whole thing. And then, like you said, it jumps into the story with these punchy little chapters, which you can mow through because it's written in such a casual and unacademic way that you feel like you're just reading, I don't want to say like just reading a romance novel, but it's written like it's meant to be consumed quickly. And it's just this wonderful thing where you're sucked into this incredibly deep and twisted narrative with these short little jazzy chapters. And it's just like, it's so weird. It's so weird, but I love it.
It's so incredibly readable. I picked this up thinking it was going to take me like days and days to read because I assumed it was going to be dense, and I mowed through it in like a day and a half. Like this just reads so quickly. And even though my favorite book is East of Eden, I have a deep affection for short books because I think there's such a challenge in writing a book that's really slight on word count, but still getting your message across. So I think there's a special level of craft there. So I loved that about this. I think another thing this book does brilliantly is just maintaining that bleak tone. And when we are saying bleak, everyone, this book is so bleak.
It's so dark. Like, I cannot stress enough that this book is so dark. Like, you know, it starts with him being in prison and gets darker from there. Like, it is just not, he's waiting. Like, this is the first chapter. I'm not spoiling that much. No. He's literally waiting in execution. Like, it is so dark. And it only gets worse from there. Like, it's just everything that can go wrong. And it's happening to a man who is a Nazi. And you're just like, it's just horrible. It's just horrible.
It really is. And it's funny because when you say the word dark, sometimes there's this perception that dark literature is like excessively gory, excessively violent, maybe just like hard to read. But this is a different kind of dark. This is way more unsettling. And
it's a love story too, which is the most galling part to me. It's incredibly romantic.
There is so much romance in this book. I mean, you can tell that Campbell for a long time just envisions himself this great romantic. I mean, it's kind of where his whole literary career started, and you just get that impression. But I think what really drives that darkness home is by incorporating that black humor. You're able to achieve this other level of darkness by having this sort of numb tone. And I think what really makes this numb is every single character has this tone to them. They're all just catatonic, like in the war, outside the war. Like there are the children have been just utterly scarred by this.
Yeah, but you're right that every single character in this book, you know, you don't like to think about the truly evil people of World War II doing it as going through the motions. You don't want to think of it as something that they did casually or like just because it was their job. Mm-hmm. You want to think of World War II as like really, truly like actively dastardly and evil people. Mm-hmm. But so much of this book of the people in Campbell's life are people who just kind of like, oh no, it's just work. It's what I do, you know? And in that sort of cavalier tone to it too, like it makes you feel even worse about what you're reading.
I think another part, even tapping into the tone, the part of this book that made it feel so relevant to me was just the evidence of cognitive dissonance among some of the side characters. Mm-hmm. So like we spent some time talking about Campbell, but like Campbell's got like a posse. Like,
yeah, he's got a team.
He's got a team. He's got that. I'm bad at names, but he's got Mr. Racist Dentist Man. He has, who is his own thing. He has these other characters too. We have the father, and then we have the quote unquote Black Führer. And
oh yeah,
and those two, like when they're incorporated in here, and they're arguing over who constitutes a quote unquote colored man. And mm-hmm. there's this dialogue here. It's deeply uncomfortable. And then you also think like, God, this shouldn't be as relevant as it is.
You know, it's very alarming. And then the worst part is like heads up for you for when you do eventually read more Vonnegut, mm-hmm. just in case you do. A lot of these characters appear in other works of his Ooh. As well. He has kind of a revolving cast of terrible human beings that he juxtaposes against his protagonist in many of his different books. And so like, you know, Howard Campbell is actually one of those characters. He pops up in Slaughterhouse-Five. And then you have like the racist dentist and all the other white supremacists. And it's just, they do like kind of pop up in notes or in casual asides in other books. And so he does over his span of novels, he kind of likes to remind you that like these people are here and they're not going away.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so interesting because I mean, obviously, I never think about talking about the election much on my podcast, but it's going to happen. But I mean, in our current yeah. political timescape, we're dealing with, even in this most recent election, people are often voting against their own interests. You can make that argument. This book really feels so relevant in that way because these are perspectives that we can't afford to completely ignore. These are perspectives we have to acknowledge because they are here and we need to understand where they're coming from, even if it makes us feel icky.
You know, it's hard too because I feel like Vonnegut didn't want to treat a lot of these characters as real people. They are caricatures mm-hmm. of deeply evil people that that have existed and still do exist. And I feel like Kurt Vonnegut wanted to make them ridiculous so you like to separate them from reality, but at the same time, like, it's so real to know that these people, like people of that level of ridiculous, still did exist. I mean, there's no way that you can be on Twitter for more than 15 minutes and talk about politics and not realize that like the guy with the really racist concept of dentistry is real. Like he has to be real. Like in this incredibly screwed up world of 2020 that we live in, like eugenics and teeth, like you're going to Google it and find it. Like it's real. It's so gross and real.
It's so real. I can attest to it as someone who I'm a genetic counselor. And so in my coursework, we definitely have to grapple with the history of genetics, which is innately tied to eugenics. And mm-hmm. we studied a lot, just some of this pseudoscience that had its origins way back when, but continue to persist. And it's through people like this that they continue to persist. And I agree that these are definitely caricatures. I think Vonnegut knows what he's doing when he chooses to make his caricatures rather than his characters. I think you can mm-hmm. even argue in some ways that Campbell himself isn't a fully fleshed out character. He's an incredibly biased narrator at the very least. We don't yeah. get to know him because his perspective is so screwed up.
You know, this is one of the few books that I can think of where like nobody really does make a change. Like, there's no real, you know, and Howard Campbell at the end, like, there's no real, like, 180 in perspective and things like that. Like, no one grows. It is just a recitation of, like, events. And I think it works really well here because adding to the bleakness, this idea of, like, some people don't change is a deeply dark thing that we don't like to acknowledge. Like, even now, you know, I myself have been like, you know what, surely some of the people who voted for Trump will come around. And it's like, nope. Some people just don't change.
And the fact that you see that people don't change, you get the impression that these things can happen again. And that adds to that haunting tone to this whole book. Like, you get the impression that this is a single snapshot in time and this is not a unique situation.
Yeah, I completely agree. Because, like, I feel like if someone wrote Mother Night now, but said it as someone who had, like, was in the first go-round of Bush's war in Iraq and Afghanistan, it would be very similar. You know, if there's people who really thought they were in a holy war, or they were doing this, like, for their country, or, like, you know, might have, you know, done some truly horrible things, you know, in this case, America is the not so great side, you know, and they really might have just, like, felt really, really strongly about what they were doing when they were doing it. And then, like, afterwards, they're said, but I didn't really mean it.
Right.
Like, it feels very truly American to me to have this person who did a whole bunch of terrible, awful, war crimes-y stuff and then was just like, yeah, but no. Like, don't hold it against me.
Right, absolutely. And this is another book that I, at some point, I want to ask my beloved Jewish friends, like, how do you see Vonnegut as a writer? How do you see Vonnegut's work? Like, how is this perceived in your communities? Because as a non-Jewish person, it's hard for me to make sense of it, but I can imagine this would be rather uncomfortable.
Yeah, I can imagine it would be because, you know, I'm very similar to Vonnegut in background of like, you know, I am not Jewish. I come from a place that it has a decent Jewish population, but like, I'm just not of the culture. I am extremely white and actually all of my family is German. So like, you know, there is also just like that sort of grappling of like, could this be family, you know, distant family? That's a very scary part of Vonnegut's also like grappling with his play in the war as well. And it's just like, you have, it's just a deeply uncomfortable thing to think about. And I have to say that when I read it in high school, I did have a bunch of Jewish friends in class with me, and I don't remember the discussion or if they had ever felt comfortable speaking up about like, why the hell did you make us read this book? It's gruesome and terrible.
Since we're talking about Vonnegut as a whole, how would you place this book in Vonnegut's catalog? And so obviously we know this is your favorite, but I guess I'm interested in seeing the voice that he has here, you know, his trademark satire, his black comedy. Do you think this is something he reaches his peak with here in Mother Night, or is it something that continues to develop in some of his later books?
What's really strange is that most of Kurt Vonnegut's books are really weird. Like, there's always a science fiction element to them. There's often, you know, like grand disasters or aliens or like deeply just, for lack of a better word to use, like fucked up people. Like, they just are, they're very, very weird. And this is actually probably his most straightforward narrative where there's nothing supernatural at play. There's no aliens. There's no just like weird coincidences. There's no like grand murder plots, which is something that happens, I think, in Player Piano. Like, it's just a straightforward narrative. So I think this is one of his more outlier books because people, when they love his books, normally they're like Slaughterhouse-Five, which is Billy Pilgrim has become unstuck in time, or you have Cat's Cradle, which, you know, is this huge disaster narrative, and it's all about coincidence, and Breakfast of Champions is all about like the weirdness of coincidence and stuff like that. And this is just like, this is what I did in the war. It seems almost mundane.
Yeah, I think that maybe that's why I liked this one so much. I'm not a big sci-fi reader. I've been trying to get more into the genre, but I tend to gravitate towards more modern science fiction or written by women science fiction. But I think this one just felt very un-Vonnegut in terms of the overall impression I had of him. I was like, wait, where's the aliens? Like, I was expecting them to pop up.
Yeah, it's not absurd. Yeah, there's no absurdity in this. Like, it's absurd in the way that, like, you don't want to think human beings would actually act like this, but it's not absurd in the way of, like, and all of a sudden there's aliens that look like toilet plungers. Like, that just doesn't happen. It's not here.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so another thing I want to talk about is, let's talk about Vonnegut's moral of the story. I don't know if your edition, I think all the editions have this, but in the introduction, he talks about how this is the only book he knows the moral for, and mm-hmm. states it right out there at the beginning of the story, like right in the introduction. And I wonder why he did that at the beginning, because to me, it felt like a conclusion I would have rather wanted to make myself. And the fact that he mentioned it at the beginning, I was like, I mean, it was still a surprising book in a lot of ways. But when I saw it at the beginning, I was like, oh, okay, I get it. But like, I could have come to that myself.
You know, I actually really like the fact that he says it outright. And I'm just going to recite it because it actually gives me goosebumps. Because, you know, just we are what we pretend to be. So we must be careful about what we pretend to be. Mm-hmm. And it seems so simple and so basic. And so, like you said, like, oh, yeah, no, I could have drawn that conclusion. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I really do feel like it feels almost biblical or religious to me, in that, like, he doesn't want you to take anything else away from this. Yeah. He doesn't want you to be like, to waffle about Howard Campbell. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want there to be any kind of like, emotional or moral waffling about what's happening. He's just like, this is it. You only have one life. You make all the decisions and you have to live with them. And for someone to be that bold and prescriptive in something that happened, that, you know, like, he's also somewhat lecturing the people who thought they were on the quote unquote good side of the war, of just like, whatever you did, you have to live with forever. And to me, I don't think a lot of Americans get that kind of, like, you know, knuckle wrapping from a lot of people, of just like, sometimes what you did was bad. And you have to deal with it for the rest of your life. And I love that.
Right. I that does definitely put a new spin on it. And especially when you think about America, I mean, we're still grappling with so many aspects of our past, and so many people are unwilling to sort of look at them the right way. I mean, you think about the monuments that aren't being torn down, the Civil War monuments. And then meanwhile, you look at Germany and they have no Nazi monuments, nothing, at least to my knowledge.
I don't believe so. I think they all came down.
Yeah, I think they've taken them all down.
Yeah.
But you get the impression that this is a culture that may have in some ways come to terms with it on a cultural level, but not always do people do that.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I love the most about the moral is that, like, you can't hide behind anything. He's like, if you're pretending to be evil, then you are just evil. Like, I feel that way a lot about how people behave on Twitter, where they're like, oh, I'm just trolling you, or like, you know, you have the sensation, I'm sorry, I can't think of the right word, of people who call themselves shit posters, who just like say mean and terrible things because they can, because they're mm-hmm. hiding behind an anonymity. And I'm just like, you are that person because you're taking time out of your day to be that person. You don't get to just like log off of Twitter and then go back to being like, I don't know, like a pediatric nurse or something like that, and think that makes up for the fact that like you're mocking people and being racist and terrible on the internet. Like, you're being racist and terrible on the internet. That's you. That's who you are.
This book is so applicable to internet culture too. I mean, like, online dating, or just like being like mm-hmm. a person on the internet, you get the impression that anonymity is real and that this is just a new identity you're creating for yourself. But no, in the end, like, these things are inextricably linked to who you are in real life. And sometimes you have to come to terms with that.
Yeah. For the fact that this book is 60 years old, it's both, wonderful and galling that it's still applicable mm-hmm. to life that we live every single day. Like, I didn't want to think that something that was written in like the death knell of World War II and grappling with all the horrors of it still is applicable when everybody who was involved in this is now passing on. Like, there's very few people left from World War II, and still their grandkids, me, is dealing with all of this stuff, and it's awful.
Oh my gosh, that's so true. Last thing is, I don't know what edition of this book you own, but does yours have a swastika on the cover?
It does. Sorry. Heads up, everybody. I actually own several editions.
There you go. You own several.
Yeah.
Because I got this from the library. I had to wait on hold for it for a while. And then I pick it up and I look at it and I'm like, well, I can't read this in public. Like,
yeah. No, one of mine, one has a swastika on the cover and the other one just has a bomb. The one that belongs to my husband actually just has a bomb on it. Mine has a swastika, which probably not great. But yeah. Yeah. Sorry, everybody.
Yeah.
Be careful.
Yeah, I just looked at this and I'm like, how do I take a picture for Instagram now? Like,
oh no, I'm sorry.
Oh, you're fine. I'll just cover it up neatly. We'll figure something out.
Yeah.
But oof. Oh my God, this book was an experience. So it's so hard to separate this into things I liked and things I didn't like. I mean, like, none of these characters are likable, but they're not really supposed to be.
Nope.
So you don't always have to have likable characters and like a happy ending and for a book to be, you know, really amazing. And this book was in so many ways, and it was a fascinating reading experience. But what comes with such a fascinating reading experience is at the end of my episodes, I always like to recommend other books, and I have a hard time finding points of a comparison to this one. I think the closest I can come is like, read Kurt Vonnegut's other books. And if you want another post-war numbness, read some Hemingway. Like, that's what I got, everybody. Emily, do you have recommendations for people that might read Mother Night and enjoy it and want some similar kind of books?
You know, one of the things that just kind of popped into my head off the top, because you're right, Hemingway does have this sort of same thing to it, just with way more anti-Semitism in it. It's maybe telling something about me, because I actually really like Hemingway's work. I realize he is terrible, everybody. Like, fully realize what he's saying is truly awful, but I also really enjoy his work. I think people don't give him enough credit for the fact that he was grappling with PTSD and mental illness, which puts a different lens over a lot of the stuff that he wrote. Not to really beat the drum for Hemingway, because, like, don't read it if you don't want to. I'm kind of looking at my bookshelf because I do have a tendency to lean towards, like, really bleak stuff. You know, I think that maybe like something along the lines of American Gods might actually kind of work really well with this, of just that sort of grappling with history and the future at the same time. That might be an interesting sort of corollary. But I mostly read, let me be honest with you, this is the deepest book I read. Like, I don't really love like super like literary fiction. So I'm just like, I don't think any of my mystery novels are going to go along with this.
No, actually, no, but I love that, because I'm struggling and I'm like, okay, what do you usually compare to Kurt Vonnegut? And I'm like, what sci-fi have I read? But I'm like, that doesn't fit this either. It's just a tone that you're trying to reach for if you want a book like this. I think the closest comp is just, and I don't read a lot of black comedy. It's not a genre I typically gravitate towards. No,
actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm looking over at my mystery shelf, and, you know, Dashiell Hammett, you know, most of his, he was a Pinkerton agent for a very long, and, you know, all of his works do kind of revolve in that post-World War I, post-World War II world of just like everybody scrabbling and trying to like make the best of like the crappy situation that they're in. And I feel like that goes really well with this as well, of just that sort of noir-y sort of emotionless emotion that takes place in this book specifically, not most other Kurt Vonnegut novels.
Right, right. And I think similarly, if I'm thinking of sort of that post-war ennui, like the book that's popping in my head right now is Sylvia Plath's Bell Jar. And that's probably because I'm thinking of that first sentence. It's like the summer they executed the Rosenbergs. And there's just that catatonic state that she's in for much of this book, from what I remember of it. And it's interesting to compare Sylvia Plath and Kurt Vonnegut. They don't, I wouldn't put them at the same table at a wedding, but...
Could you imagine? Just put them in the corner. Oh my gosh. you know, but now that you mention it, like, I'm going to be curious because so much of modern writing, please feel free to cut this out if this goes off on a, like an absolutely wild tangent, but so much of modern writing has been incredibly emotional and incredibly like, it's like therapy in a book is a lot of modern day literary fiction. And I wonder if we're going to start seeing more of this, like this distant grappling with trauma and emotion now that hopefully we are, air quotes, moving away from another really, really dark time of American history, of just like, you need that space in order to deal with it rather than like, here's a diary entry of all of the trauma, but with like the names have changed.
Right. Yeah. That's so interesting to hear. It reminds me of a tweet I saw somewhere where, to paraphrase the tweet, it said something like, you know, 30 years from now, one of the kids that was separated due to the family separation policy is going to write a book. It's going to win a Pulitzer. And we're going to forget that this was like a real thing that happened.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a really astute thing to say, of just like, we're going to forget about all of the horrific things that happened, you know, on top of that have been more horrific than the usual stuff that America does, mm-hmm. of just like, and we're going to forget about it. And we're going to feel so guilty when we're reminded of it. And we should.
Whew. And on that lovely, cheery note.
Sorry.
No, I came into this episode being like, we are going to laugh and cry simultaneously, everybody.
Yeah, pretty much.
But on that note, Emily, if everyone wants to check you out, check out your work, how can we find you?
You bet. I am mostly on the internet. You can find my webpage at Fuckboys of Lit. That's B-O-I-S, fuckboysoflit.com. I am on all major social media platforms at Fuckboys of Lit. And my personal Twitter is Ms. Emily Edwards, M-S Emily Edwards. And I lurk basically on Twitter all day. And if you'd like to find my podcast, you can search for it on all podcatchers with the words F-B-O-L or the letters F-B-O-L, because people don't like the word fuckboy. So I had to couch it a little bit.
Thank you for that, Emily. And I realized we didn't mention this in the episode proper, but everyone, the day we are recording today happens to be Kurt Vonnegut's birthday, and we did not know this prior to starting. So November 11th, Armistice Day, now Veterans Day, also Kurt Vonnegut's birthday. So just wanted to shout that out, even though he's been dead a while.
Yeah. That's true. Happy birthday, Kurt Vonnegut. You were a very weird one.
He was. He lived a lot longer than I thought. Like,
yeah, a lot. A lot of his like later essays are fantastic. Like as he got old and he was just like, I don't give a shit anymore. Like Man Without a Country is a really good collection of essays. I highly recommend it.
That's so interesting. I'm gonna check that out, because I see him as so like in a particular time period that you forget he had a life after that.
Yeah, he wrote a lot of heavy critique of George Bush and the Bush Wars and stuff like that. Ooh. And it's a very emotional, it's a bit of a gut punch to read someone who, you know, had such a terrible time in World War II, and almost all of his books are based around World War II, to kind of give that perspective to George W. Bush and what he was doing. It's very, very interesting social commentary.
I will check that out. That sounds fascinating. But everyone, thank you so much for listening. Emily, thank you so much for being on my show and introducing me to Kurt Vonnegut and Mother Night. I'll have a link to buy the book on my bookshop.org page, or you can find it at your local library. Do support your libraries. And as always, check in with your favorite book every Thursday. We've got new episodes. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was a blast.
If you'd like to get in touch with the Your Favorite Book podcast, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at YFB Podcast. So that's YFB Your Favorite Book, Instagram and Twitter. You can always get in touch and I'd be happy to hear from you. And as always, don't judge a book by its cover, but do judge a book by its lover. See you next time.